Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. The pre-med year, session number 352. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Welcome to The Pre-Med Years. Thank you for taking some time to join me today. I have a very special guest that I'm excited to share with you today, Dr. Alden Landry, an emergency medicine physician who has taken it upon himself, along with some colleagues of his, to help the path of underrepresented students into medical school, dental school, and other health professions by starting Tour for Diversity. Now, when I found out about Tour for Diversity, I reached out to Dr. Landry several years ago, and I said, hey, I need to get you on the pre-med years to share your story, to share your encouragement, to share your resources with my audience, with my listeners. And it took a couple years, but he's here sharing his story and making your journey to medicine that much more accessible. Hope you enjoy this episode and go check out tourfordiversity.org. Alden, welcome to the pre-med years. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
When did you realize you wanted to be a physician?
That's a great question. I'd probably answer it in two parts. I knew I wanted to go to medical school before I knew I wanted to become a doctor, if that makes any sense.
No, it doesn't. I would love to hear that explanation.
So, just for clarity. So when I was probably in the third or fourth grade, my grandfather, who was a cattle farmer in East Texas, told me that the smartest type of doctor were veterinarians because they took care of patients and couldn't communicate with them. and so I had this understanding that, this belief, thanks to my grandfather, who I looked up to, that veterinarians were, the sort of the top of the food chain, intellectual food chain, when it comes to doctors. And then I decided at some point that I wanted to become a doctor, but I didn't know what that meant. Mm-hmm. But I got to college and I met a bunch of people who wanted to go to medical school. And it was easier to wrap my brain around that next step of getting into medical school or going to medical school than it was to becoming a doctor and actually what it entails to be a doctor. Yeah. And so from a stepwise fashion, I could, going from college to medical school made sense, but going from college to doctor, I didn't understand the steps that were in between to get there. I didn't know the steps that were in between. And so I knew I wanted to go to medical school. And then I said, I'll figure out how to become a doctor when I'm in medical school. Okay. So hopefully it gives a little bit of clarity as far as my thought process when it comes to answering that question.
Definitely. That definitely helps. And I think as we progress in our conversation today, I think that probably... that lack of understanding potentially is it sounds like that's something that you're out there to fix as we progress in our conversation. So you ended up going to medical school eventually. What was the pre-med process for you? You said you had a bunch of friends in undergrad who also wanted to go to medical school.
For you, what was that process like? Were there any big obstacles in the way, or was it smooth sailing?
You know, anybody who tells you it's smooth sailing is selling you a bill of goods. So for me, I was fortunate. I was truly blessed along the process. I ended up at the right college with the right set of mentors, the right set of advisors, and the right set of people to surround myself with. And I think that's the reason why I was able to sort of navigate this process a little bit smoother than some. So I went to a small HBCU, Prairie View A&M University. It's right outside of Houston, Texas. And it's, you know, not a well-known institution unless you know HBCU football, whereas we had the longest losing streak in college football history. Or if you're into college bands, when we perennially have one of the best bands in the country.
Yep.
But we also have a very strong, and I say we because I still consider myself both a product and a supporter of my university. But Prairie View has this great track record of putting minorities, specifically African-American or Black students, into careers in the health professions, whether it be medicine, dentistry, optometry, pharmacy, and nursing, and even veterinary medicine. But I ended up going to Prairie View for a number of reasons, but it definitely was the right choice for me and the right time for me. I participated in a program. It was a health careers opportunities program called Pre-Medical Concepts Institute. And it was this great summer program that started before your freshman year of college, where you come in and you sort of get this entree into what it's like to be a pre-medical student. You do a course, your freshman biology course. You get these intro courses to chemistry, both inorganic and organic chemistry. You get a intro to calculus and physics. And, you know, those were the sort of the staples as pre-med requirements. And so you do this program, but then you're also in a part of a cohort of about 30 or so students who all come in expressing an interest in becoming a health professional of some type. And you meet individuals, you study together, you're on campus together, you learn sort of the culture of the institution. And it was just great segue into what it was going to be like to be a college student with a pre-med focus. And it was during that time that I, you know, really had a better understanding of what it took to get into medical school. And that was a springboard for me going forward in college. I won't say college wasn't easy. Wasn't a breeze for me. I did have a lot of fun in college. My time in college was great. I did have some struggles, of course, with courses, and, you know, I'm not afraid to admit I took the MCAT twice. The first time I took the MCAT, I thought I was going to be, you know, just fine. I remember taking the first time preparing for it. I didn't really prepare. I was like, I've already taken organic chemistry. I've taken a couple mock exams. I know where I'm scoring.
Yep.
And I didn't study like I needed to. And, you know, I took the MCAT back when it was only offered twice a year. And
on paper.
It's still on paper, on Scantron, no less, yep, in a big auditorium. And I took the exam. And I, when I'm telling students, I feel like, you know, after I took the exam, I feel like I lost a fight to Mike Tyson. And I was beat up. I was sore. My head hurt.
Your butt hurt.
And yeah.
Sitting that long.
Yeah, my pride definitely hurt.
Yep.
And I got my score back, and it was sort of a shock to the system. And I said, well, I know what I need to do, and that means I need to train for it. I need to prepare for the exam. So I did.
Why did you have that thought process versus, well, I guess I'm not smart enough to be a doctor. Let me go figure something else out.
Great question. I think the reason why I knew that, well, first off, I knew I could do better. So there was that intrinsic drive that just told me, you can do better than this. And this score does not represent who you are as a student, as a test taker, and as an applicant to medical school. And I just knew internally that the score did not represent me. I also knew that I had to do better if I wanted to get accepted to the medical schools that I wanted to go to. It just wasn't realistic for me to apply with that score and think that I was going to be able to have a choice in getting into medical schools. And then also I had the people around me saying, Alden, you didn't take it serious the first time. You didn't do what you were, you know, advised to do ahead of time. Why don't you take it and be serious about it? And so it was, I guess, maybe all of those factors coming in, and said, Alden, you have to retake it. And I did. And, I took a very different approach. I took, I would say 4 mock tests sort of each week before I actually took the exam. I took a mock test once a week for the 4 weeks prior to the exam, I guess is a better way to say that.
Yep.
I studied, I did questions, and I even did a little summer program that was offered at the University of Louisville School of Medicine. And it was a preparatory program for the MCAT for underrepresented students in medicine. And it was a phenomenal program. And I, with all of that preparation, my score went up tremendously. And I went from being concerned about applying to medical school with such a weak score to really having opportunities to sort of pick and choose where I wanted to go for both interviews and also where I wanted to go when I was selecting a medical school.
Talk about, you said the score that you got, you knew it wasn't going to, or you needed to do better to get into the schools that you wanted to go to. What was the thought process behind why you were choosing the schools to go to?
So I'll be 100% honest with you. There was a little bit of superficial thought into which schools I wanted to apply to, and not in the way that I was looking for sort of name recognition or things like that. So I'm originally from Texas, and I consider Texas home, even though I grew up as an Army brat. And I lived in other parts of the country, and I knew that it was important for me to be comfortable while I was in medical school. And so I wasn't looking at a lot of schools in the north, because I am not a fan of cold weather, which is interesting because I live in Boston now.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah. So, but I was looking for, you know, schools that were going to be close to, you know, where I considered home, that was going to allow me to have the comforts that I was looking for. I wanted to be within driving distance of friends and family, but I knew I needed to be outside of, you know, Texas, because all of my friends and family were there. So I needed to have that buffer. But I needed to be able to overcome that buffer if necessary. And I wanted a school that was going to train me and allow me to grow both as an individual with interest, but then also just to be cultivated as a medical student and sort of, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's and to help me become the doctor that I aspired to be once I figured that out in medical school. And so with all of the schools that I was applying to, I looked at schools pretty much, you know, in southern states, warmer weather states. I was looking for a state school as opposed to a private school because I wanted to control the cost of my education. I was looking at places that offered support for underrepresented minority students. And then I was honestly just looking for a place that I felt comfortable. And, you know, we always talk about in medicine that gut feeling or the gestalt. And when I walked into my institution, that I chose for medical school, which is the University of Alabama at Birmingham. It felt right. I felt comfortable. I felt like I was at home. I had, because of another program that I participated in, I had already developed a relationship with the institution. And all the other schools that I applied to were great. And I got warm and fuzzy feelings from a number of them. But there was only at one place that I really felt like I was going to be supported and allowed to grow the way that I was hoping to. And I think I chose well.
You ended up going into emergency medicine. What was the thought process behind picking your residency?
So I chose emergency medicine after a bit of a sort of medical student crisis, sort of like a midlife crisis, but for medical students. And my medical school was a traditional school, whereas you did 2 years sort of free clerkship in the classroom, and then your last 2 years were in the hospital. And because, as I mentioned earlier, that I knew I wanted to go to medical school, but I didn't know I wanted to be a doctor or what type of doctor. When I started medical school, I relied on other people to sort of give me advice and tell me what I should be. And so I knew that I liked anatomy. I knew that I liked working with my hands. So everyone told me I should be a surgeon. And I sort of bought into that mentality, and I had convinced myself that I was going to be some sort of surgeon, I guess, towards the middle of my first year of medical school. And I joined the surgery interest group and started shadowing surgeons. And, you know, things were going along the path of me becoming a surgeon. And then, as you know, with me going to a traditional medical school, I didn't get exposed to surgery until formal rotations in surgery until, I guess, January, February of my third year of medical school. And this is right about the time that most people have sort of figured out what they want to be in medical school and have committed to it through research and mentors and letters of recommendation. And I got to my surgery rotation and I absolutely hated it. It just wasn't for me. I didn't like the hours. I didn't like the fact that I was standing in one place for hours. I didn't like the fact that I couldn't take a bathroom break, or I was getting hungry. And not to, you know, take anything away from surgery and their training, it just didn't fit me, and I wasn't comfortable. I knew I wasn't going to be happy as a surgeon, and hence my medical student crisis when I was getting towards the end of my third year, and I hadn't decided on what I was going to, you know, I the one thing that I committed to as far as a specialty, at least what I'd been telling other people, wasn't going to be. I knew it wasn't going to be a good option for me. And so I had to scramble to really figure out what was next. And as luck would have it, or maybe not luck, but again, just being blessed, I had a mentor who was there all along the way who happened to be an emergency medicine doc. And he sat me down and he talked to me about what my interests are, my likes and my dislikes. And he said, well, what did you like about your peds rotation? And so when I was going over my peds rotation, I talked about the time that I admitted a patient who was having an acute asthma flare and needed stacked bibs, and we almost had to put him in the ICU. And then when he asked me, what did I like about my psychiatry rotation? I said it was going down and taking care of the, you know, acutely psychotic patient in the emergency department who was being aggressive. And then he asked me about my neurology rotation. And I said, well, we were taking care of those patients who had strokes or who were seizing, and we had to adjust medications to stabilize them for their epilepsy. And he sort of helped me realize that I like the acuity, and I like the sort of the acute interventions for people who were ill for whatever reason it may be. But I didn't like the long-term aspects of the care, whether it was the inpatient management of pneumonia or titrating medications for high blood pressure or diabetes. That wasn't what sort of excited me about medicine. And he said, why don't you come and hang out in the emergency department with me and do a short elective in the emergency department. And if you like it, you know, we could figure out how to help you match an emergency medicine. And he was 100% right. He was spot on. And it turned out that I loved emergency medicine. I liked the variety, the people, the management of the illnesses and diseases that presented to the ED. But I also love the people, and it's the staff that you work with, the nurses, the techs, the other docs that you're working with. I love working with the patients that presented to the emergency department. And I realized that all along, emergency medicine was a specialty for me. And that's really when I committed to emergency medicine was towards into my third year. And I had to scramble and do away rotations, find opportunities, and I was fortunate to come up to Boston and do a visiting clerkship program based out of Harvard Medical School, and ended up matching here for residency, and been in emergency medicine ever since.
Up in Boston in the cold.
In Boston in the cold.
Gotta love those winters. Oh, man. I don't know how much of my story you know, but I was in Boston for on and off for about a decade, which I'm glad I'm not there anymore. But you mentioned, right, you realize you don't want to do surgery, and you were courageous enough to really make that stand. I think a lot of students in that situation will go, well, I need to save face, right? I've told everybody I'm going to be a surgeon, so I might as well just keep going down this path. Maybe I'll like it later on. And unfortunately, too many people do that. You mentioned that you went to a mentor, and it's not the first time you mentioned that kind of the people that you have surrounded yourself with are really the ones that are helping you figure this out as you go. Now, I think especially as an underrepresented person in medicine, for pre-med specifically, they struggle finding those mentors, finding those people to surround themselves with. Why do you think you were so successful doing that?
You know, it's a great question. I think a lot of people struggle with finding mentors. It's because they don't do the follow-up. And what I mean by that is I go to conferences often. From my perspective, when I was a medical, when I was a pre-med student, and then as a medical student, and then I'll flip to sort of my perspective now that I'm on the other side of things. But I remember as a pre-med student, I would get handed a business card from someone, whether it be at a conference or they would come and give a talk in my school or whatever it may be. And, you know, me being me, I'm a fairly outgoing person. I would take the business card and send out an email or make a phone call and just have conversations, because I was in need of direction and knowledge. My family is, as I mentioned earlier, from East Texas. There's no doctors in the family. We have farmers and ranchers in my grandparents' generation, and then a younger generation. My parents' generation worked in factories, and then many of them left that life to join the military. And at no point did I have anyone who was related to me that I could just turn to and say, "Hey, what's it like to be a doctor? How do I study for the MCAT? Or, you know, what's the application process for medical school?" That wasn't our conversations that we had around the dinner table. So when I met people, I had questions for them, and so I would start with simple questions. You know, what is it like to be a vascular surgeon? What type of patients do you see? When you're doing radiology, you know, what's the path to become a radiologist? And, you know, you start with those questions, and people love to talk and share their stories, because they're always looking. I would say many people who are passionate about mentoring and advising love to just have conversations. And sometimes it's a one-off conversation, and other times it leads to something, but you never know if you don't send the email. And so I was that person who, if I got a business card, I would more than likely reach out to that person. And that's what allowed me to identify mentors and identify people who are going to be in my life constantly to help me to make it to that next level. And then, so I'll say that now that I'm on the other side and I'm the one who's in a position to be the mentor for many students, it's not uncommon for me to go to a conference and I'll go with a stack of business cards and I'll give out 50 and I may get 5 emails back. And so it's those students who send me emails that I'm able to build a relationship with and, you know, set up shadowing opportunities for them or talk to them about their personal statement or help them navigate career or course loads for the year as they're planning to study for the MCAT. And it's those students who don't email me that I have to wonder and worry about because I don't know what happened to them. I hope that they go off and they have other, maybe better mentors and better support. But I just feel like it was always a missed opportunity because I try not to, you know, if I'm giving you my business card, I think it's important for me to be not just doing it for show, but actually to help out those who do reach out to me and look for advice. And, you know, sometimes when I'm talking to a student, you know, I can't always, you know, have a sit down meeting with them, but I'll talk to them while I'm driving to work. So, you know, I have a 25-minute commute. That's 20 minutes, 20 minutes of my commute. I can be having a conversation with a pre-med student about, you know, their choices and which direction that they want to go. Or I can have a conversation with a medical student about choosing a residency program. And so I try and use those times that I'm otherwise available, you know, to just be open and share with those students. And I wish just in general, and it doesn't necessarily just reflect on me handing out my business cards, but I think that there are a lot of people that are out there who are willing to, you know, use that, you know, that time that they're commuting or in between meetings, not just to send out more work emails and press delete on the mass emails that they get, but they would love to actually have conversations with students. If only the students actually did their part and actually stepped up and started the relationship with the mentor.
Let's talk about the students doing their part, because I get emails from students a bunch, and sometimes I get these like 10-page just autobiographies and the students just pouring their hearts out. And you're a busy physician. I'm busy trying to help as many students as possible. What's the best way for a student, if you handed them a card, for them to reach out to you and let you know that they need your help?
Yeah, I get those same emails where it's, you know, you're reading it and then it's, you know, a personal statement within an email. And the ask is buried at the very end. And so for me, I would say what makes things easier for me when I'm looking through the emails after a conference is the email with their name and sort of where we met, sort of right up front, and the conversation we had, the ask that they want right up front, and then a little bit of background as to the why for the ask. And so if it's, you know, "Hey, Dr. Landry, we met at you know, Student National Medical Association conference, and you mentioned away rotations for visiting students. Just so you remember, I am a fourth year medical student at state school, and I am going to be applying into, you know, a certain subspecialty. I was wondering if you had a chance to sit down and talk, or if we can set up a phone conversation to talk about how to best apply for away rotations. You know, short, simple, clean emails are always best with just a reintroduction, the question, and then the why for the question. And that helps me to sort of gauge how much time I'm going to need to invest in this initial conversation, and then what I'm expected to bring to the table when I have the conversation with the student. Then after that, I really think it's on the student to determine whether or not they want to continue to interface with the person that they started the conversation with. So, you know, I'm happy to have informational meetings with people that are 20 minutes and tell them about opportunities that I have in my office. But if the student wants me to become their mentor, the onus is really on the student to cultivate that relationship. So it's not just sending the first email, but sending the follow-up email, sending the updates. And it doesn't have to be a weekly email or a monthly email. I don't necessarily talk to my mentors every week or every month, but I send them an update every 4 or 6 months, or when something major happens in my life, personally or professionally. Or I give them an update when I have a question or I'm trying to make a decision. And I know this is something that they may have either sage advice, or this is their area of expertise. And so I think it's really important that students are conscious of the ask that they have for their mentors. But then they're also, they understand that these relationships require cultivating if they want them to continue. And really the onus is on the students to help build those relationships. And eventually the mentor will realize it, whether it's stated formally or not, that this is a mentor-mentee relationship and it needs to be cultivated as well from their end.
Yeah. So you're a busy physician and teacher and faculty there at Harvard, and you decide to start Tour for Diversity. What was the impetus for starting that organization?
Great question. I think the reality was we started the Tour for Diversity because, well, the backdrop is we were, so Cameron Matthews is a colleague of mine. She's a co-director of the tour, and she and I were both on the board for the Student National Medical Association. She was the president, and I was in a role called the pre-medical board member. I was a medical student, but I was responsible for really cultivating or generating content for pre-med students and making sure the needs of the pre-med students were met in the organization. She and I were on the phone one evening after planning our national conference for the SNMA. And we talked about what it would take to get more pre-medical students involved and what the needs for the students were for the organization. And we realized that, you know, we were asking a lot for pre-medical students. We're asking them to come to a conference that they really didn't have a great understanding of what it was going to be about, paying travel. So whether it's a flight or bus or carpooling, staying in a hotel room that they may not be able to afford for a short conference, and was that what was best for the students. And then we started talking about, and this is all in the same conversation, how do we flip the model and make it so that we bring the conference to the students? And it went from that to us putting together a PowerPoint presentation to presenting it to our colleagues in the Student National Medical Association, to even starting to solicit funding for this idea of taking a conference to students on their turf, where we overcame a lot of the barriers that may prevent them from coming to a larger conference. So we would bring the conference to them. We would help set up the information. We would bring in the experts, the content experts, to their institutions. And the only thing they had to do was show up and learn. We came up with this idea while we were medical students. And we thought it was a phenomenal idea. Unfortunately, no one else did. No one took us serious. So we had to table it. And as things would happen, Cameron would go on to do her family medicine residency. She also, at some point, went to law school in there as well.
Why not?
I went on to residency. We both started growing professionally and getting fancy titles at institutions. And for some reason, people tend to answer an email when it comes from, you know, .harvard.edu when a doctor is sending an email looking for grant funding. You know, it happens like that. And so we send out emails looking for funding. And now that we are doctors who were still unproven, but more gaining expertise in this arena, people started to take us seriously. And we pitched it to a couple funders, and we were eventually able to find funding for essentially the same content that we had planned many moons ago as medical students on taking a conference to students. And that was really the beginning of the tour. And we had this phenomenal first program the first year that we did the tour, where we went to 5 historically Black colleges in the South, and we were on a bus going from campus to campus and doing these pop-up pre-med conferences where we'd show up on campus at 8 o'clock in the morning. We'd put our flyers up and put our banners up and our tablecloths out, and we'd host this amazing pre-med conference. And by 4 o'clock, we were leaving that campus and getting on the bus and driving to the next campus to do it all again the next day. You know, it was great that first tour. We met so many students who it was their first time seeing young Black and Latino doctors and dentists who looked like them, who had similar stories to them, and who were sharing their expertise. And you mentioned earlier about students always looking for mentors. Well, one of the things that we did was not only did we bring the content to the student, but we brought potential mentors to those students. Yeah. And it was a great opportunity for students to identify mentors through our organization that could potentially help them with their careers.
How long ago did that start? Because I think it's been around for a long time now, hasn't it?
Yeah. We initially came up with this idea back in 2006. We weren't actually able to execute it until 2012. So I think the moral of that story is if you have a great idea and it gets, you get told no, it's not always no, it's just sometimes it's not yet.
Yep.
And for us, it was a not yet situation.
Yeah.
And so we started our first tour in 2012, and we've done tours and other events and webinars ever since then. We took a little bit of a hiatus on the road because both professional growth for Cammie and I, because we're both practicing physicians and administrators and in all our other hats that we wear. But we're actually planning on our new iteration of the tour, which is a different program that's going to be restarting in 2020. So be on the lookout for the next iteration of Tour for Diversity 2.0.
Breaking news right here on the podcast.
Exactly.
So what can students be on the lookout for? So somebody listening to this now, unfortunately, they can't go back in time and be part of those earlier tours. What can a underrepresented in medicine student be doing right now to start finding those mentors, to start getting that information from the tour or any other organizations out there?
So one of the things that we did was we knew that this information needed to be cataloged in some form or way. And so we have a couple of things that are available on the web. We have a YouTube channel with all of our videos where we take our hour-long presentations that we typically do on the tour, and we condensed it down to 10 or 15 minute more consumable, easily consumed presentations. And so all of that stuff still lives on the web on our YouTube channel. We're on Twitter and Facebook, and we're constantly posting about events, opportunities for students, whether it's for undergraduate students or medical students. We have our blog that's still active and also archived, so you can go back and read old blogs from the tour. And then all of our mentors, which is I think a testament to the folks that have committed to being a part of the Tour for Diversity in Medicine. They're engaged in so many different ways when it comes to pre-med students, and whether it's they've started their own programs or they're working within their institutions. And we're all available. We still mentor. I still get emails from students that I met on some of our earlier tours that are asking for advice as they're applying to medical school. And I get in, you know, emails from students who weren't able to participate in the tour, but because of institutional memory, their institutions, you know, hosted us on some of our earlier tours, and the pre-health advisors at those campuses, they still have my email address and they email me. And so students can reach out to us. We also are working with other institutions, both here at Harvard and also the Mayo Clinic, to actually start to talk about how this can be, how pre-med advising needs to be updated and how pre-health advisors can be more engaged. And so I do work with the National Association of Advisors for the Health Professions. We have this conference that we have where we're talking about physician diversity with the Mayo Clinic. We do our, we partner with pipeline programs here at Harvard. And we also partner with the AAMC and some of the work they do with their Summer Health Professions Education Program. And so we still have our tentacles out and are working with a number of organizations. And what I would say is if there's a pre-med student that's out there that's lost and looking for advice, always come to the tour. And if we can't help you right away, we can point you in the direction for the organizations and the institutions that can better serve you and help you to achieve your dream.
So there are going to be plenty of students listening to this going, why does it matter, right? Why do we need to put in the time and effort into cultivating the next generation of underrepresented physicians? Because in their mind, it's like survival of the fittest, right? Highest MCAT score, highest grades, those are the ones that I want to be doctors. So those are the ones that should be doctors. Why should we be putting in all this effort?
I guess the first place to start is, I don't know if I've ever seen a study that correlates MCAT or GPA or step one scores with quality and safety and outcomes for patients. Yeah. And so just because you have great numbers and you do well on taking tests doesn't mean that you're going to be a good doctor. And that is, that's regardless of race, ethnicity, country of origin. And I think what we are realizing in medicine, and we're coming to this very slowly, is just because you're a good test taker doesn't mean that you're going to be able to sort of go that extra mile to take care of that patient who has a need that isn't met by a textbook answer. And we had this discussion years ago about health disparities, and we've moved on to really talking about health equity. And I think medical schools are starting to see the light when it comes to who they accept to medical school, in that they're trying to accept students who are going to be addressing health issues, not just by prescribing medications and performing surgeries, but also going out and addressing the needs of rural communities or inner city communities or vulnerable populations like immigrants or the LGBTQ community. And so what we need to do is not just focus on the grades in the MCAT, but what's going to be the outcome? What's going to be the impact that that person accepted to medical school is actually going to have. And I think some of that goes along with race and ethnicity as well. I mean, if you look at who takes care of patients who are more likely to be on Medicaid and serve in underserved communities, it tends to be providers of color. And so if medical schools and really the whole institution of medicine is really interested in creating a health equity, then we have to think about who we accept into medical school and what they're actually going to do as doctors. And not just about how well they did on the MCAT.
What do you think is the biggest barrier for those who are underrepresented coming from lower socioeconomic parts of our country? Why do you think they're so few and decreasing, as the studies show, every year, decreasing people who want to go to medical school?
It's partly you can't be what you can't see, and people can't necessarily see themselves as a doctor. It's a lot easier to see yourself, you know, as going into the family business, whether it's construction or farming or, getting a 9-to-5, because you can see people who make that transition from, student or high school student or college student into those roles. It's a lot harder for people from disadvantaged backgrounds to see themselves becoming doctors. I think it's a multifactorial issue that we need to really look at and try and unpack. But there's not a one answer will fix all of the problems. I mean, if you think about the data, when you look at students coming from disadvantaged backgrounds, I think they say that the AAMC data states that 80% of medical students come from the top two quintiles of family income. Mm. And so if you come from an affluent family, there's more resources available for you. You have a higher likelihood of getting into the colleges that are going to turn out students that are going to go into medical school. You are going to be able to afford the test prep services that those coming from different disadvantaged families won't be able to afford. But then also, as I mentioned earlier, when you're coming from a disadvantaged background and an underprivileged background, the conversations that you have about education aren't the same. The conversations that you have about how to be successful, how to identify mentors, just conversations about science and the language that's used in the home is very different than what you're going to be exposed to. And I think that we need to realize that there's a lot of talent that's being underdeveloped merely because of the way our finances and wealth is distributed in our country.
Yeah. For the student out there listening to this who hasn't been able to see someone like themselves in those roles, whether it's physician, nurse, vet, whatever, and they're struggling on this journey. Obviously, they're listening to this podcast right now, listening to this conversation, but they're questioning whether or not they can do this. What do you have to say to them?
You can. You can do this. And I would say that you have to step outside of your comfort zone. You have to stretch yourself and push yourself and take advantage of some of the opportunities that are out there that will help you grow. And so I would encourage, you know, those freshmen and sophomore students who are out there to do programs like the Summer Health Professions Education Program, SHPEPs, which is sponsored by the AAMC. Mm-hmm. I would ask those students to look into their communities and see if there's an active National Medical Association or National Hispanic Medical Association chapter or AAIP, American Indian Physicians Organization, and see if they have a chapter that's out in their communities that's active and engage with them. I would ask that the students see what opportunities are happening locally as far as volunteering and community service at hospitals that they that could be exposed to physicians and dentists and other health professionals. I would also challenge students to not just, and you know, it's hard for people to accept this as me as a physician saying this, but to think about other careers in the health professions, because becoming a medical doctor isn't necessarily the right decision for everybody. Mm-hmm. But think about opportunities in pharmacy or optometry or podiatric medicine or nursing. And think about if that is a lifestyle that actually fits you better than becoming a medical doctor. I think oftentimes we hear from students and it's doctor or bust. And the reality is you can have a parallel plan or you may not just be appropriately exposed to other professions. And once you get that appropriate exposure, you're actually going to find something else that you like, and you like it better than medicine. And for me, it was choosing emergency medicine over surgery. But for some people, it may be choosing dentistry over medicine or optometry over medicine. And so when you have those exposures, you can see that there are other opportunities that are out there that may make you happier. You may find more career fulfillment in another specialty.
Where can students go get more information about the tour and everything you're doing there?
Biggest way to reach out to us is on Facebook, Twitter, and our website. The website is www.tour4diversity.org. Or you can reach us at Tour for Diversity on Twitter. We're on Facebook as well. Then you can also reach out to me, AM Landry MD, on Twitter, and I can put you in contact with people as well.
All right, there you have it. Again, Dr. Alden Landry, an emergency medicine physician and co-founder of Tour for Diversity. Hopefully you got a lot of encouragement out of this episode today. Hopefully you got a lot of motivation. Hopefully, if you are an underrepresented student on this journey, you can see that it is possible. And there are people in front of you that have done this, that look like you, that talk like you, that come from the same places as you. And I loved his quote, right? If you can't see it, you can't be it. I think I'm going to steal that quote and use it everywhere from now on. But it's completely true. And something that we're working on here at MedEd Media is a book called Pre-Med Mentors, where we're going to gather a bunch of underrepresented physicians and physicians who come from different places and look differently and speak differently. And hopefully there's a pre-med student out there that will find that story and it will resonate with them, and it will give them the motivation to move forward on this journey, to know that they can be a physician, because we need more physicians like you. So go check out tourfordiversity.org. You can spell it F-O-U-R-F-O-R, the number four. Alden only had the number four diversity.org, but I went out and bought all the other websites. So spell it however you want, and you will get to where you need to go. Tourfordiversity.org. Hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time here on The Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.